Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 73, Quantum Money, with Jiahui Liu. Jiahui did this research while she was at the University of Texas at Austin. She is now at MIT. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/73. Show notes include links to the paper we talked about in this podcast, as well as any other relevant links that I can think of. And now, Jiahui Liu.
Hey, Jiahui, how's it going?
Good, good. How's it going for you, Jim?
Oh, everything's wonderful with me. Thank you. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this paper I saw, Another Round of Breaking and Making Quantum Money, How Not to Build It from Lattices and More. And I guess this paper is with Hart Montgomery and Mark Zandri. I thought this was very interesting because it, you know, showed me something about quantum cryptography that I wasn't aware of previously, which is basically this, how this quantum money scheme is really fundamental to quantum cryptography in the long run. And I think people would be interested in finding out a little bit about it, not just because it has such a cool name. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. So in this particular case, another round of breaking and making quantum money, you had two objectives, right? As I understand it. One was you were looking at a previous attempt to create a workable quantum money scheme. And then you put together your own scheme for making quantum money. And I guess a little bit later on, you actually put together some criteria for quantum money as well, which is very interesting. So what I'd like to know is really, what is the problem that you're trying to solve here with the work that you're doing in this case?
Yeah, right. So the major problem, as put in the title, is quantum money. So this is something, if I think some of you might know, Wiesner put forward many years ago, basically in the 1960s. So that was quite a pioneering idea. So the problem states that, okay, there is a bank and a user. Each prepares a quantum state that comes with a serial number, which specifies its uniqueness. And the bank just gives this money state as a banknote to a user. If the user wants to spend this money state, it might just come to the bank, and there's a very efficient verification algorithm that allows the bank to check whether this money state is the valid quantum state that is prepared according to the procedure specified by the serial number. But the user is not able to generate two copies of the money states that both pass such a verification algorithm. So that is the very original security we want with quantum money. But there is something not so good here in this scheme put forward by Wiesner. So Wiesner did actually give a construction for this scheme. So they just basically just use polarized photons. So those are just unentangled qubits. Some of them encode 0 or 1 in the computational basis. Some others are encoded in Hadamard basis. And if you don't know which basis for each qubit is chosen to encode the bits, you won't be able to measure the state correctly. And if you just try to disturb the state, you are just going to probably destroy half of the bits, and you are not able to get another quantum state that also passed the verification. But the best thing about this scheme is that it's not publicly verifiable. By saying that, it means the user always has to go to the bank to verify whether the state holds in hand is a valid money state. Because the bank is the only authority that holds the secret key, which says what is the basis that encodes each of the bits in this money state. So with the correct basis, I can verify whether this is a valid money state. But if I publish this information of the basis, clearly it's not secure, because if the adversary knows the basis information, it can measure each qubit in the correct basis, and it recovers the underlying secret. And it can prepare as many copies as the money states, as many copies as it wants for the money states. So this is not good. So want to improve upon this scheme is that we want some different money states or a different scheme where the bank can, along with giving out a quantum state to the user, it also gives out some classical side information that allows the user or like anyone doing transaction with him to verify whether this money state in the user's head is a valid money state. So clearly this public key, it would somehow leak a bit of side information of the money state, because you are trying to verify whether the state is a valid state. So there must be some secret hiding inside this key that allows you to verify, right? So if the user is unbounded, that's not good because it could just try all possible combinations, enumerate through all possible states, feed it into this verification algorithm, and try to see if it passed the verification. And it can always figure out what the money state is. So the thing is, this user must be bounded. It must be an efficient algorithm. But even given all this, even given these new restrictions, it's still a problem that's hard to solve. So there has been some past solutions for this problem, but usually they are built on strong computational assumptions. So computational assumptions are what we use in cryptography, are usually mathematical assumptions that have been investigated by people, and they believe those problems are hard to solve. And we try to build schemes on these assumptions. So all existing publicly verifiable quantum money schemes are built on assumptions that have been investigated by people in the past, by mathematicians and cryptanalysis in the past, but not so well investigated that we, it's not like 99% that they are secure. So there may be one day someone just comes up with an efficient algorithm to solve this mathematical assumption where we build our quantum money scheme upon. So that's not good. So one thing people cares about is whether we can obtain a publicly verifiable quantum money scheme from better founded assumptions. And one of them is lattice assumptions. These lattice assumptions are a problem set mathematicians and the cryptography community have been investigating for many years, and they believe they are not only secure, but are post-quantum secure. So unlike factoring or discrete log, which almost everyone knows, they can be broken by quantum computers and you cannot use them here. They are believed to be both classically and quantumly hard. Of course, there are people who don't believe that and that still try attacks. But as of now, we know, okay, there are no attacks. And these assumptions are not so strong as I have mentioned for some past, for some existing quantum money schemes that they have been using. It's a well-believed assumption and it's not that heavyweight. It's relatively lightweighted compared to some strong cryptographic and mathematical hammers people have been using to build quantum money. So basically, a lot of people in the community would ask, can we get quantum money from lattice assumptions? And if you can get them, that would be great. And in our paper, what we do is that we basically rule out a way to realize quantum money from lattice assumption. By ruling out, I don't mean that there is no possibility of building quantum money, more specifically publicly verifiable quantum money from lattice assumptions at all. There are still possible ways to do that. I can explain later, but there is one specific roadmap that people have been taking in the past, and especially these are like prestigious people in the cryptographic and mathematics community. They have been trying out this path a few times in the past, and people think this looks promising, but in fact, it's not. It's very likely that this path they have been taking is not working at all. And we show that in our paper, a relatively generic statement that says, okay, this path cannot be used to get quantum money, unless we can have some mathematical structures we have never seen before with these lattice assumptions. Otherwise, this path simply fails. And this is the first result we have. And the second result is on the good side. Okay, so we just say something about how we cannot build quantum money. But we also provide some hope that there is other approaches we can try to build quantum money, even though they are very different and they might not be so relevant to lattices. So the other result we provide is a generalization of an older paper called Quantum Money from Knots. So they built a quantum money candidate on knot theory, but in their paper, they didn't provide much correctness or security analysis. And we say, okay, if we look into their scheme, we can abstract out some mathematical structures that cannot only be built from knot theory, but they can be built from possibly many other things. And we can just generalize a framework out of that paper. And we provide the security analysis for this framework. And we provide some other candidate instantiations that fits into this framework that might give us quantum money. But again, we are a little bit back onto the path of using strong assumptions, because in order to use this framework, we currently can't think of any mathematical assumptions that has been used by cryptographers on a daily basis. We have to use something weird. something that probably hasn't been used before or has been rarely used before, but still it provides some hope. And there are some new candidates people can try to analyze. So these are basically the results we have in our paper.
So there are a couple of things in there that I think we might need to clarify. First, when you're saying hard, you mean NP hard and computationally hard. Is that correct?
Not necessarily NP hard. And in fact, a lot of these problems are not. So in cryptography, people care about average case hardness. NP hard or NP complete problems are usually just worst case hardness, so that I can find a worst case problem that is hard for you to solve. But probably if I just sample randomly from like all the problems, and I feed you randomly one of the puzzles, it can be easy to solve. But that's not what we want, because in cryptography, everything is probabilistic. So the assumptions we use, they are usually average case hard problems that, and by hard, people simply conjecture that there is no polynomial time algorithm, randomized algorithm to solve these problems. Yeah, that's the hardness we use in cryptography.
So what I remember from the dark ages, when I was an undergraduate, back then, when you said hard, you were saying that basically you may as well just try every solution. In the worst case scenario, you're going to basically keep on tracing everything for every single solution. And no matter what your algorithm does, it will, in that worst case scenario, take just as long as that. Now you're saying, this case, it's the average problem, the average random solution has that same character.
Right. Okay. Right. So.
All right. We might want to talk a little bit about what a lattice is. What is a lattice in the way you mean it, right? So, you know, I'm a condensed matter physicist. When I think of a lattice, it's different from what a mathematician usually thinks of as a lattice. So it might be good to get a little bit of clarity there.
Right. So yeah, in fact, if you just picture what the lattice look like, I wouldn't say they are quite different. They are just sort of like a bunch of points in the space. And specifically, it's usually viewed as a set of linear combinations of some basis vectors. Or you can say they are some sort of discrete additive subgroup in the Euclidean space. And usually when people use lattice, I think it's because there are a lot of problems like I'm given some basis vectors that specify a lattice. But a lattice can be specified by different types of bases. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, quote unquote bad. By having a bad basis, they do not allow you to find to easily find short vectors in the lattice. So, right. So if you have like integer combinations of these basic vectors, you would get lattice points. But the thing is that it's not easy to find lattice points that are short in their norm. And of course, I talk about all of these in high dimensions. They are meaningful in higher dimensions. And for example, one problem is called short integer solutions. This will be less abstract because this is a more concrete problem. So you don't have to imagine all the high dimensional lattice points. So for example, I'm just given a matrix that is a sort of a system of linear equations. And this matrix is a lattice. For example, if we computed over some finite field, and this is some n-dimensional lattice over a finite field, and we just try to solve this linear equation system specified by the matrix by giving a solution. Okay, this is easy. We can use Gaussian elimination. But what is not easy is that I put an additional requirement on your solution. I want this solution that can be viewed as a vector, right? Because you are solving a system of linear equations, you're providing a vector. And the vector has to be bounded in its norm. So solving the linear system is easy, but you have to find some specific solutions with a small norm, and this is believed to be hard. And this is basically the problem that these quantum money schemes using lattices, they are trying to base on. Of course, we show that they are not secure, but this is the original hard problem that inspired people to build lattice-based quantum money.
And then you apparently have some similar thing for knots. And so knots are, looking at the mathematical theory of knots, right, which, you know, goes all the way back to Feynman and people like that.
Yeah, I personally am not that expert of knot. The thing is, I think with the knot quantum money, the interesting part is that it's based on quite different problems, I would say. At least when I look at them, I don't see a relationship to lattices, but they would somehow give some hope, shed some light on a possible quantum money scheme. Yeah, we can talk about that later.
Okay, so where do you think we are now? So quite an introduction. Do you think you got through all of that background?
I think we were sort of delving into the technical part a bit earlier than I thought, because I was prepared to talk about more history of quantum money and quantum crypto in general. Oh, okay. And yeah.
We probably would like to talk about things like that, the history of quantum money and cryptography. So if you have anything to say about that is relevant to what you want to do, then let's please talk about the history of quantum money.
Yeah, sure. So I would like to first talk about an overview of quantum cryptography nowadays. I think probably like the most famous thing that both has quantum and cryptography in it is using quantum computers to break cryptography, right? So that we all know using Shor's algorithm, we basically just destroy everything people have been using nowadays with their public key crypto system. But there's the other side of having quantum computers coming to cryptography is that they can be used to construct cryptographic protocols. And they can be used to achieve something that's not achievable when we use only classical information. I think one famous example is probably quantum key distribution, where people have already been implementing and doing experiments with. And these protocols allow two parties separated in their locations, they can do exchange and set up a shared secret key between them by using quantum communication and no need to use public key cryptography. And then in the classical world, this has to be achieved using public key cryptography and using some of the mathematical assumptions. I just mentioned some of them broken, but there's lattice assumptions that's probably not going to be broken that people can use. But in the quantum world, we don't have to use all that. You just have to send the quantum information. And the security of this key distribution protocol is highly relevant to this thing called no cloning principle of quantum mechanics. So just as I mentioned, this is actually inspired by quantum money. So when Wiesner first put forward the notion of quantum money, it was sort of just ignored by the community. But a few years later, these people, they saw the paper and they were just inspired by this notion of conjugate gate coding. As I said, you encode a random classical string in computational or Hadamard basis, with the basis also randomly chosen. You are able to produce unclonable state. So without the basis information, the state just looks maximally mixed to people. And for example, in the quantum key distribution protocol, if you send over such a state over an insecure quantum channel and some malicious party if tries to eavesdrop or tries to tamper with this quantum state, at least it would fail to obtain whatever secret key Alice and Bob, the honest party, are aiming at obtaining at the very end of the protocol, if it should not be able to get, should be like information theoretically forbidden from getting that information. And there are some other unclonable primitives, cryptography constructions that are also relying on the no cloning principle besides quantum money. There is something called quantum position verification, where some prover is trying to prove that it's set in a particular location. For example, there is like a delivery app and you want to verify the users that are actually within the delivery range. So they have to prove that they are inside that range. And this can be done by bounding the distance and bounding the time that transmits the information. And using the bound of speed of light, you would be able to predict whether the user are within a particular range. The bad thing about this scheme in the classical world is that because classical information is always copyable, if you have multiple malicious provers, and try to prove their location, they try to fake as one person and prove their location, they are able to do that. But with quantum information, again, you can break such attack. With quantum information, the excluding provers could not succeed in some settings. And there's another scheme that's an extension of quantum money that's called quantum copy protection. So in quantum copy protection, we want to encode even more complex classical information into the quantum state. So we want the user to use these unclonable quantum states, not just to get past the verification and say, okay, this is my money. We wanted to use it to run a classical function or possibly a quantum functionality. So for example, a software company wants to sell a piece of software it just published. And if it just sells a piece of classical information that runs the functionality, this is not copy protectable in the sense that the user can always just copy the entire classical information, no matter whether it's encrypted or something, as long as it can be used to run. And it's classical information, the user can always just take the whole code of that software and make many copies of it and sell them to others. So these are pirate copies, and the company wouldn't want that. So what it wants to do is that it prepares a quantum state, and it requires the user to use this quantum state in order to run its software. So now we have a piece of classical software, but it's bounded with a quantum state in order for it to run. And the user is not supposed to produce two copies of the quantum state that allows it to run the software correctly. So that's one of the major unclonable cryptography constructions people have been working on these days. And there are also some other areas in quantum cryptography I would like to mention briefly. So there is also post-quantum analysis of classical cryptography. We know that classical cryptography, for some of them, they are broken, but there are still some of them that has been not, right? So they use assumptions, mathematical assumptions that's not subject to the Shor's algorithm. But the thing is that this is not enough, because in the quantum world, the adversary not only can perform Shor's algorithm, it can do many things. So for example, it gets a piece of classical encryption or a classical algorithm or a classical program. What it can do that it sometimes runs these softwares or these functions in superposition and try to extract information in a way that a classical adversary cannot. So some of these constructions, even though they look secure at the first glance, okay, they do not use factoring or something, but they can be subject to quantum attacks. And people have been using specific ways of analyzing the security of these classical constructions with respect to quantum adversaries. And these analyses can be quite different from what people do with the classical world. And this is important for us to know, okay, even though these cryptography constructions, these protocols, they do not rely on factoring or discrete log, but we have to make sure that they actually are secure against quantum adversaries. And finally, there is this field of replace classical communication with quantum communication to reduce the assumptions we need in some protocols. And this is kind of related to the first area of unclonable cryptography I talk about, related to quantum key distribution, because this is something we achieve similarly for quantum key distribution. But we want to go beyond that. Using quantum communication, we can not only allow Alice and Bob to do key exchange, we can allow them to do something more advanced, like something called multi-party computation, where, for example, Alice and Bob, they both hold on to some classical input and they want to jointly perform an evaluation on their input. So Alice as input one, Bob's input as input two, but they want privacy as well. They do not want to leak their inputs to each other. So for example, this input is how much money Alice and Bob each has in their own bank account. They sort of just want to compare like which of them is the richer one, but they do not want to their specific numbers in the bank account to be leaked to the other side. So they want to perform that a joint computation that only gives them result who is the richer one without leaking the specific numbers. And people can use quantum communication to realize such a protocol by using fewer mathematical assumptions people have been using to realize such a protocol when they only allow classical communication between Alice and. This is one example. And so this is basically another field quantum cryptographers have been researching on. And they find it quite interesting because quantum communication sometimes allows us to do the same thing as the classical world we can do, but it can do it in a more information theoretic way, I would say. Even though it's not really information theoretic, we still need the adversaries to be bounded. We still rely on some assumptions, some harness assumptions, but we can reduce the number of assumptions needed. So that's basically an overview for the quantum crypto world in general. And for quantum money, I would say, I think I've already talked a lot about it. So there's this bank, it issues a money state, and it wants to apply the no cloning principle so that no user with one copy of money state can generate two. So, and this is not achievable in the classical world because the classical information is always copyable. In particular, nowadays, on the internet, everything is digital, and you might get your ways to hack and make copies of transactions and double spend your money. And sometimes some cryptographers may claim that, okay, blockchain similarly can achieve this goal of preventing double spending. But with blockchain, people have to make assumptions on the users as well. They have to make sure that the majority of users are honest. The majority of the users are following the protocol so that we can guarantee this system goes well and no one can cheat. But the thing is, this is probably not true, and a lot of times not true in the real world. But with quantum money, you don't have to rely on such assumptions on users. You just have to rely on your trust in quantum mechanics. And in terms of quantum money, the history, as we talk about, Wiesner put forward a private key quantum money, that is a quantum money scheme where only the bank with the secret key of the quantum money can verify this money state. And nowadays, the development has mostly been focused on creating public key quantum money. And this is what I mentioned, one major goal in our paper. Nowadays, people have been focusing on build quantum money scheme where even if I give out some public information that leaks a bit of information of about the quantum money state, but it allows people to verify whether a money state is valid and it doesn't leak so much information. And the money state remains unclonable in the eyes of a bounded adversary.
So you want this quantum money state to have, you said, a public key, right?
Yes.
And well, I guess in the paper, it sounded like you have the private key, you can still have some sort of bad actor pretending to be the bank. Was that correct, or did I misread something?
For the private key setting, yeah, I mean, there's indeed different settings, there are different attacks we care about. So for the private key, basically, if the bank just honestly generates the money, say, and it holds on to the private key, and if the user comes to back, if the user is trying to be malicious and it gives an invalid money state and tries to figure out information about this state by going through the verification procedure, and if the bank is not careful in this, for example, if the bank, it verifies the money state, okay, says, okay, it's not valid, but I give back to you. You are probably doing something wrong, but I don't suspect you are being malicious, and give back the money state to the malicious user. This is bad, because if the user can do this many times, it would be able to figure out what the this money state, what the conjugate encoding would really look like. So this is basically one attack against Wiesner's money state. But in some sense, we are making this state publicly verifiable because the user goes to the bank and invoke this verification procedure many times. And this is some sense of a public verification because the user are using this verification algorithm many times.
One thing that I thought was interesting, again, was that quantum money was not just, you know, an interesting thing. There are a lot of advances in quantum cryptography that require you to be able to make quantum money or quantum money to work in some way. Could you discuss that a little?
Oh, yes, definitely. So I think I just mentioned two things that relies on or at least related to quantum money. So one of them is quantum copy protection. So quantum copy protection is the scheme where the software vendor wants to sell a piece of software, but it doesn't want it to be copied. So it has to put some quantum information along with its classical functionality and give this to the user. And the user needs to use both pieces of information, the quantum part as well as the classical part, in order to use this software functionality in a correct way. And what we don't want is that the user can make two copies so that both of these copies have the same functionality as the original function we're trying to copy protect. And this scheme is stronger than quantum money, and it's somewhat relies on quantum money, but you need something more. So one thing we can observe in our past work is that copy protection for some specific functionalities would imply a public key quantum money. So the idea is that if we can build quantum copy protection, especially general quantum copy protection for a very large class of software functionalities, these functionalities, you can view them just as a classical Boolean function or something. If we can do that, we can just build public key quantum money. So that basically says that quantum money is like one basic stone that we need to build copy protection upon, but it's not enough. We need something more. But if we cannot even get quantum money from well-founded assumptions, then there's probably no hope for us to get copy protection. from well-founded assumptions. So that shows some hardness for these unclonable primitives, especially primitives that's linked to public verification. There's a lot of challenges in there to build from well-founded assumptions instead of strong hammers. And there's also position verification. I would say this one, I wouldn't say it would rely on quantum money, but indeed you would be able to use something very similar to Wiesner's quantum money or to the quantum key distribution protocol to realize a position verification scheme. In some of these position verification protocols, people would do similar things as in just do the conjugate coding thing. And basically the challenge is to recover the underlying classical secret encoded by the random basis. And I wouldn't say this relies on quantum money, because I think this basically just all goes back to the no cloning principle and goes back to the properties of this conjugate coding state.
Now, in the paper, you did two things. I mean, we talked about that a little bit, but we're going to start getting into it a little bit more now. One was you showed that one lattice-based quantum money scheme, one lattice-based public key quantum money scheme was not viable. And the other was going to be something you built with knots. So I'd first like to just talk a little bit about the first part of the paper.
Yeah.
And I'd like to get an overview, because this is something I think a lot of people don't really know, is sort of how does somebody use mathematics to show that something can't be done?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a really great question, because I can understand that this statement is not quite intuitive at the first glance. So more specifically, what we show is that a specific construction of quantum money cannot be done. It's not like we're saying, okay, quantum money cannot be done at all. That would be really strong. and what we say is that, okay, there's a specific quantum money construction that may look valid at the first glance, but simply cannot be done because of some hard mathematical assumptions that we believe and we as a community believe to be hard. So just as the security of quantum money we aim for is based on a mathematical assumption, this sort of impossibility result is also based on an assumption. Our specific statement is that suppose we can construct a secure public key quantum money from lattices that have a format as put in the Cashin Lu short paper, or actually a format as put in another paper by one of my co-authors, Mark Gentry. If this construction conjecture by them is secure, then we can use such a security to break a certain lattice assumption called learning with errors. And this assumption is investigated, has been studied by the crypto community many years, and people in general believe it's a hard problem. So it's quite a funny statement that the security of the quantum money is somehow based on the insecurity of the assumption. And if you believe the security of that mathematical assumption, or say you believe the hardness of that mathematical assumption, then a quantum money scheme like this cannot be secure. And this is basically the statement we have. We can go into a little bit more details if you want. So the thing we show is that a lot of this subtlety actually lies in the need of public verification. Just as I said, a private key quantum money is easy. We can do that with conjugate coding, with BB84 states, and with a lot of other stuff. But when you have public key, you have to have a procedure that allows you to verify the quantum money, and everyone can see this public key, including the adversary. So what can you do to prevent the adversary from taking advantage of such public information is that you have to hide it in some tricky way so that this public key allows you to verify the structure of the money state, but doesn't really help you to learn the entire structure. However, we cannot do this with the quantum money from lattices scheme proposed by Cashin Lu Shor, because there's actually a way that the adversary can always cheat by taking use of this public key information. So basically the adversary can in fact measure the quantum money state after it receives it, and it somehow adjusts this measured state with some of the public key information given. And since it has measured the state, it can copy this information and do this many times. So it can produce two states. And we show that these states produced by the adversary, through measuring the original money state and adjusting the measured state with the public information, it can always pass the verification. So why can't always pass the verification? And this part relies on an assumption. Building on the assumption, we basically can show that no matter what verification procedure you use, there's simply no efficient way to distinguish this fake money state produced by the adversary through measuring and modifying. You simply cannot distinguish it from the original money state. And suppose you have an efficient way of distinguishing them. Okay, congratulations, you are breaking this assumption called learning with errors, which people believe to be hard, and that would be another piece of big news. This is basically the high-level roadmap for showing something cannot be done in our paper.
All right, so that's why the lattice quantum money does not work. Did you feel you had a really good description of your security
properties? By security properties, you mean the lattice-based quantum money or the node-based money?
So what I wrote here probably had to do with lattice-based money, and I think when I was reading it this morning, I was looking at the second.
Okay, I see, so. I see. Yeah, I can try to explain both. I mean, for quantum money, the high-level thing we want with quantum money is always the same. We want it to be unclonable. And in terms of public quantum money, we want this quantum state to be computationally unclonable. So that is given, even given all this auxiliary information, the adversary is still not able to produce something that passed the verification. But unclonable is a very information theoretic thing, right? Because it's quantum mechanical. It's simply not doable because of non-linearity. But the thing is, in the real world, we're giving like a lot of auxiliary information with this public key. And also these quantum money states, they are somehow algebraically structured. And it's simply not very easy to show that the unclonable in the sense that the adversary has to produce two states exactly the same as the money state. In fact, it does not, right? So just as the attack I talked about, the adversary can produce something that is in fact probably far away. It's not that far away in trace distance, perhaps, but it's not that close to the original money state. And it can be prepared and copied because you can somehow turn it into classical information. But the thing is that these allow you to pass the verification in some settings. So this has been attacking towards many of these past public key quantum money schemes, is that you don't have to actually clone the state, but verification basically allows you to go through, even if you don't actually clone the exact state, you just have to produce something similar to that original state. So in order to show the security of a quantum money scheme, we have to make sure that we have to show that, okay, based on some hard conjectures, some assumptions, there is no adversary that can produce two states that pass the verification, instead of saying two states that look the same as the original money state given out. Yeah, this is basically the security property we want. And in order to show such a security works, we would have to go through like something that doesn't look like no cloning. But in fact, for example, we want to say that suppose the adversary can produce two things that both pass the verification, then I can extract some classical information. It could be quantum, but in our settings, a lot of times, because we want to build on classical mathematical assumptions instead of a purely quantum mechanical conjecture, we say, okay, wait, I want to extract something classical from the first copy of the fake money state that passed the verification. And I want to extract something classical, some piece of classical information from the second state that passed the verification. And by using these two pieces of information together, I am able to break an underlying mathematical assumption that I want to base my money scheme on. And this is the usual roadmap we use to show the security of our money scheme. In one sentence, we just want the adversary not be able to produce two things that go through the verification if it's only given one money state. And the idea on how we show such security is that we basically try to extract information from the money state and we do something called reduction, right? So I am like an intermediate algorithm that tries to solve a hard math problem. And I take use of the behavior of this quantum algorithm that tries to clone the money state. I take use of this quantum money adversary and whatever it produces to me, suppose they pass the verification, I can use such information to break the mathematics assumptions I want. And this is the roadmap we use to show security a money scheme.
And you were able to do that with the lattice money.
Yeah, the thing is we are not able to do that, right? So we believe we're able to do it after taking like the first glance at the scheme. The idea is if we're able to have two money state that pass the verification of the verification algorithm of this lattice-based quantum money scheme, we're able to extract information from the first state and some information from the second state. And then we combine this information together and we're able to break a lattice assumption. However, this does not work because people have not really overcome the barrier that this verification procedure is public. Okay, suppose this verification procedure is not public. It's simply performed by the bank or by some trusted authority out there. And it can hold on to some secret information. And such information can be used to verify these money states. And it probably would allow this thing to work. But since we want this public verification to be out there and this verification procedure needs to be efficient. However, once we try to do such a thing, we would actually have an attack. And the adversary would always be able to create two copies of states that pass the verification. And that would not allow us to extract the information we want. Because in fact, they do not have such information. And in fact, what they do is they cheat in our eyes because we as verifications, we are efficient algorithms and we cannot distinguish these fake states from the real money states. So that is quantum money is basically like a failed example of the reduction approach that I try to show because such a reduction cannot get through simply because in order to do that reduction, you already have to know the secret. But as a public verification algorithm, you should not be able to do that. You should not be able to know that information. So it sort of contradicts itself at the very beginning in some sense. And we show that, okay, this in contradiction is in fact there because no such efficient verification algorithm exists unless you assume something is wrong with this assumption people have been using.
But you have what you think is a scheme with knots that's going to do that.
Yeah, in some sense. But again, we have to rely on things that's not so investigated by mathematicians and cryptanalysts. So we have this framework that will work when we actually show a provable security. But the thing is, we show all this provable security relying on a mathematical assumption that's sort of new, and we're still waiting for more analysis on that to see whether it's a valid assumption or it's probably something in our imagination.
And what is that assumption?
Right. So I wouldn't say it's a not theory-based assumption because it's more general than that. At least we hope it's more general than that. Is that we call it path-finding assumption and knowledge of paths. So basically, we say that suppose the adversary can produce two money states and both pass two fake money states that both pass a verification. We are able to extract some information from the first state and extract some information from the second state. And these two objects, they are classical information and they are some element that lies in a certain equivalence class. And there's basically a problem that basically says that, okay, it's simply hard to find such objects, especially to find a path that goes from one object in the equivalence class to another. And suppose we're able to find two random objects like that, we are able to just output a path between them. Okay, I think that I'm a bit jumping ahead and this probably doesn't make sense. I will try to make it more clear. So in the knot-based quantum money scheme or in the more generalized framework, the money state is a uniform superposition over all the objects in some equivalence class. So for example, in the knot-based quantum money, these objects are knots where you can move from one knot to another using something called a red master move. Suppose I pronounced that correctly. So basically this is like you just apply some operation on one object and it would be able to move to another object in the same equivalence class. And what the adversary cannot do is that it cannot produce two uniform superpositions, which are of the same equivalence class when it is only given one copy. And if the adversary is supposed to do that, we're able to measure the first copy and we would get one object in the equivalence class. We would get, with high probability, we're able to get another different object in the same equivalence class because it's a uniform superposition of many objects. And we believe this allows us to simply find a path from one object to another. This is believed to be hard for many of the problems. For example, knot theory, if you are given two knots, I'm not quite sure if this is a well-founded assumption, but just an analogy in our case is that if you are just given two random knots, not something you choose on your own. Because if I measure it, I get a random knot. I do not easily get some knot I can choose on my own. I measure another state, I get another random knot. Okay, I know that they are in the same equivalence class in the sense that I can perform a bunch of moves that allows me to go from one to the other. But the thing is, I know that there is such a path, but it's not easy to find, especially when I'm given two random objects. But suppose, okay, I can choose an object on my own. Of course, I can always make a bunch of moves and I can get another object. If I produce these two objects on myself, okay, then I'm able to output this path. But the thing is, if I given two random objects and I'm just asked to find the path between them, it's not easy. And there is similar hard problems in some other structures. And we believe we can use such a framework that generalizes the knot-based money scheme into something we call invariant framework. And in this framework, basically, we have these sets of elements that can be divided into equivalence classes. And within each equivalence class, there is a permutation. There is always a path of operations that you can operate a sequence of actions on one element that allows you to permute to the other element. And the hard problem says that if you just get two random elements in this class, you are not able to easily find the path between them. And if you are able to output two elements on your own in the same equivalence class, you should be able to know a path. And that is something we call knowledge of path assumption. And basically, we believe this looks secure-ish. And at least we don't see some attack on them. And also, even for the knot-based quantum money scheme, because I think not many cryptographers have actually tried to figure out other cryptographic schemes based on knots. So it's not a very well cryptanalyzed field. But these problems look hardish. And we give out this framework that you can try to fit in other algebraic structures that looks like many equivalence classes and you can permute within the class, but it's hard to find a path where you do not have the option of choosing the objects on your own. We say that, okay, we basically have many other candidates that's probably going to fit into this framework. That gives us some hope that these conjectures are actually true. So that's basically the second part of our results, is that we provide this framework and we bring up these very generic assumptions called hardness of path finding and knowledge of path assumption. And we say that, okay, based on these two assumptions, we are able to prove our quantum money secure, and there's a reduction to do that. However, on the other hand, we also provide some instantiations of these assumptions that would show that there is some hope for these hardness of path finding assumptions from knots, from cryptographic, something called cryptographic group actions, also some other cryptographic conjectures based on not concrete mathematical assumptions, but more abstract cryptographic protocols such as obfuscation and pseudorandom permutation. Yeah, and these are the instantiations we provide to say that, okay, we think there is some hope that our conjectures on the hardness of path finding is true. And knot-based quantum money is one of them.
Very good. You also mentioned something about quantum lightning. Do you have anything to say about what that actually means?
Oh, yeah. So actually, quantum lightning is just a strengthened version of quantum money, right? In quantum money, we have this bank, which holds on to a secret when preparing the money seed, right? So there is this classical secreted first samples, and then it based on the secret, it prepares the money state. So it gives this money state to the adversary, but it holds on to this classical secret itself. With this classical secret, the bank can always produce as many money states as possible on its own, right? Because it is the authority that generates the money state, it knows everything. And since some settings we don't want this, we want the whole thing to be more decentralized. Okay, what if we can like deprive some power of the bank? We can make it even hard for the bank to produce two money states with the same serial number, or say two money states that look the same. So this is quantum lightning. In quantum lightning, the money state generation algorithm, it allows to generate a money state, but every time you generate, there is some inherent randomness in the state generation procedure that prevents you from generating two states, unless you have unbounded computational power. But if not, you're not able to generate two money states that look the same. So every time you generate, it's going to be something different. And suppose there is like some procedure that keeps track of all these money states. Every time you generate, you register this money state somewhere so that at serial number, of course, it's unique and guaranteed by this the inherent randomness of this generation procedure. But simply, and even if you as the person who generated money state, you are not able to produce two money state that have the same serial number. And so if you try to double spend, you are not able to do that because all the serial number, they keep track somewhere. And unless you are able to generate two money states that looks exactly the same so that they can have the same serial number, you are not able to do any double spending. And this is a strengthened notion because in the usual quantum money scheme, we have a secret key that allows us to generate the quantum money states. And this is much easier. So you don't know have the secret key, it's hard to clone. This procedure of generating quantum money state is completely public. You simply have to use some public randomness, some sort of randomness beacon, some trusted randomness resource out there, and you can generate your money state on your own. But once you public the serial number out there, okay, it's fixed, and you are not able to do that twice. So it's harder to realize, and I think one reason people like and want to try this lattice-based money scheme is that it actually, the very first scheme put forward by Mark actually had this property of being a quantum lightning scheme, because this generation procedure of the lattice-based quantum money in Mark's scheme is in fact a public procedure that allows you to generate a different state every time you run the procedure, and it's hard to collide into the same state. And the thing with the caching Lu Shor paper is that they modify this scheme so that it's not a quantum lightning anymore. But I mean, suppose it's secure, it's still good because we have quantum money from lattice, but it's not. And basically the question of quantum lightning is still wide open in the sense that it's harder to realize. And even for quantum money, we have some provably secure constructions, even though from very strong cryptographic hammers. But there are still some provably secure structures. But for quantum lightning, I don't think there is much has been done out there besides using oracles. I can specify what oracles are. So they are basically very idealized models of algorithms that you can only access via a black box access. So for example, you are using this algorithm as a black box unitary. You can, but you don't see what the circuit really looks like. It's putting a black box. You can run the unitary and you can run its inverse. However, you're not able to see what it is doing in there. So this is kind of often used in analysis of complexity theory and sometimes quantum complexity theory and sometimes using cryptography as well. But we believe it's a strong use because the thing is, how do you turn a circuit into an oracle? Because in the real world, there's always some concrete code that no matter it's a quantum circuit or it's a classical circuit, there's always a circuit out there. And you have to hide it really carefully. You have to hide it using some magic to make it look like a black box. So there's a quantum lightning scheme based on such assumptions. But since such an oracle is quite strong, yeah, I would say, yeah, it's even like more magical than some of the mathematical assumptions we use. So in general, the picture about quantum money and quantum lightning out there is, okay, quantum money we can build from cryptographic assumptions, even though they are strong, but okay, they are still relatively more acceptable, especially by the cryptographer community. And therefore, quantum lightning, okay, they are actually also constructions, but they have to take use of these all-powerful oracles, which implement some complicated quantum or classical circuit, but you are not able to see what's going on inside. And that's something even stronger than whatever people use for the quantum money side. So that, yeah, in another way shows that quantum lightning is a harder problem to solve.
Was there something else you'd like to continue on with this? Anything else in this paper that you think we've missed that people would be interested in?
Let me see. So, okay, I've talked about how we show that a specific type of lattice quantum money don't work, and the security properties we're looking at. Probably are there some other viable alternative schemes for quantum money right now? Yeah, I would say that these are mentioned here and there in the things I talked about just now. So one of course, the candidates, I call them candidates because, you know, they are built on strong assumptions. And one of the candidates is, of course, the knot-based quantum money, as well as the generalization we're providing our paper called invariant quantum money. And there is also quantum money from obfuscation. And so this is, I would say, like among all the candidates, like this is the most well-studied and most promising one, I would say. And it has been there for a few years. This quantum money from obfuscation, so it's quite similar to what I just said. In some of these schemes, people use these oracles to hide the verification circuit, right? So as I said, a verification circuit leaks information about the quantum money state, and we don't want that. So how about just hide the verification inside the oracle? And suppose we can do that, we are good, right? So some of these past works, one of them is was put forward in 2012 by Scott Erickson and Paul Cristiano. And they used these quantum money states as some random secret subspace. These quantum money states are just a uniform superpositions of vectors in some randomly chosen secret subspace. And the verification procedure allows you to verify whether this money state is in fact such a uniform superposition of vectors inside a secret subspace. And this secret subspace is hidden inside the oracles that allows you to do the verification, because with the information of the subspace, you are able to check. But since these are oracles, the paper can show that even with access to these oracles that allows you to check the money state, the adversary is still not able to produce two copies of the money state that both pass the verification. But as I said, oracles are not good, because in the real world, everything is given to you as a circuit, as a concrete circuit. As long as you can run it, you have access to it. You can do a bunch of things with it, and it's not a black box. And what people can do is that they replace this oracle with something called obfuscation. And this is a cryptographic tool people use to hide the code, to hide the structure of the circuit, right? So the obfuscation is a procedure that you put, it could be towards a classical circuit, it could be toward a quantum circuit, but we don't know much about the quantum circuit side. So here we only talk about hiding classical circuit. When we put the classical circuit inside this obfuscation algorithm, and it spits out another program. And this program is called an obfuscated program. Obfuscated program looks very different from the original code, but it performs the same functionality. And so the thing is, once we give this obfuscated program to the adversary, it can still run the program. And in our case, it can run the verification procedure on the quantum money state, but it's not able to figure out the secret information about the subspace that we use to encode the quantum money state. And that is basically the one of the most well-believed quantum money construction, I would say, because there are concrete constructions. There are construction for such obfuscation algorithm in the cryptography community, even though most of them are not quantum secure. They have to rely on pre-quantum assumptions like discrete log. But there are also some assumptions that realize obfuscation from probably quantum secure ways, but these are not so well investigated as well. So I would say that if you ask me whether we can have lattice-based quantum money, I think there is one possible approach, that is, if we can have lattice-based obfuscation, then we can have lattice-based quantum money, because we can build quantum money from these obfuscation protocols. And I think that's basically the high-level picture of what's going on with quantum money nowadays. Yeah, and I also see there are a lot of other interesting questions going on there. For example, some people have asked about whether we can get low entanglement or no entanglement quantum money, especially with public verification, of course. With private verification, we already have Wiesner's quantum money, which all the qubits are unentangled, but that one is subject to attack once we publish the verification algorithm. Yeah, and I think this still remains largely unknown, and there's been a lot of other works studying whether we can build quantum money from certain assumptions or we cannot. Attacks or analysis on these past the existing schemes.
Okay, excellent. Very nice. So I think that's pretty much all the questions I had. You know, I think this has been really nice. So I'd like to thank you very much for coming on to the program and telling us a little bit about quantum money.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 73, Quantum Money with Xiaohui Liu. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/73. Show notes include a link to Xiaohui's paper, as well as any other links that I can think of. Thank you very much. Goodbye.